Okay, well, let's turn now to our Week in Review panelists. Joining us today, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. She's also a political consultant as well. Arlene, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Meghna. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you as well. Also with us, Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, good to have you.
Good to be with
as
you.
As well. Aside from the fact that Ed Markey has seen Hamilton, which I haven't yet, so he's hipper than I am. Arlene, your first response to what you just heard, and also just the fact that it does seem like we're sort of half a dozen hours away from potentially a government shutdown.
Yeah, it's pretty silly. I mean, this is the fourth stopgap bill that we've dealt with in the last several months. And, you know, the art of the deal when it comes to government is really the art of negotiation and compromise. You can't have everything you want. And the president has unilaterally rejected the bipartisan proposal placed before him. So has Mitch McConnell. So the president's got to do what he claims he's so good at, which is negotiate a concession at this point, just like the Democrats are going to have to concede on things that they want.
Jim, is that harder than that's easy for us to say. But when you've got the Freedom Caucus way out there on your right, the implacable Freedom Caucus, it seems, as Ed Markey would describe them, is negotiating that deal harder than we think?
Look, I would observe a couple things. One is that I thought Schumer's tone was much more hopeful than I would have thought was possible, first thing. Second thing is I take the senator's point on compromise taking two. The one thing I would note is that when the Democrats are in power, they say we want a clean continuing resolution. And when the Republicans are there, they want a clean continuing resolution.
And nothing in Washington
and
is ever clean.
It never happens that way, right? For the last, in the last 20 years, over 100 continuing resolutions. We've had shutdowns 18 times in 40 years. A lot of this is the result of the fact the budget making process is broken. We've had a real budget process four times in 40 years. One out of 10 years. Mm. Things are broken there. And it doesn't help that we have people who are probably not best suited to making compromises who are there too. But we already had a broken system. Layer onto that the partisanship and several personalities, and it makes it very hard.
Yeah.
You know, Meghna, it was interesting to hear what you said about people writing to you and not concerned about the government shutdown, because the reality is that government shutdowns cost money. They never save money. And they cause collateral damage. You know, local businesses, small businesses, particularly those that are predicated on tourism traffic, can get harmed in this severely when you have a government shutdown.
Right. I mean, I've got some numbers, some other sort of broad-based numbers here. Because there is no agreement on DACA, that's, you know, up to somewhere around 700,000 young people who are still hanging in the balance. The lack of agreement on CHIP so far, 9 million children are on the Children's Health Insurance Program. If they can't get a CR pass, that could mean that 1.3 million active duty members of the United States military could be expected to work without pay. In another aspect of what the government does, 417 national parks could shut down. I mean, we don't really know exactly, you know, what would happen, but these are the potential, some of the potential implications.
And even if people do get, federal employees do get paid eventually, what do they do in the meantime when the bank comes knocking at the door for their mortgage payment? Do they say, oh, as soon as the government acts, then you can get paid? You know, they're responsible for their bills, whether the government's done the right thing or not.
I want to play another piece of tape, and this is sort of apropos of what you were saying, Jim, a second ago about the broken process. This is Mick Mulvaney, director of the Office of Management and Budget for the White House. He was asked by a reporter this morning about why the GOP can't, because the GOP controls the House, the Senate, and the White House, why they can't get a continuing resolution through. And here's what he says.
I have to laugh when people say that, oh, we control the House and the Senate and the White House. Why can't you get this done? You know as well as anybody that it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass an appropriations bill, right? You know that.
I know that.
Okay, only have 51 votes in the Senate, then you have to have Democrat support in order to keep the government, to fund the government.
So it's interesting because Mulvaney in years past has championed previous government shutdowns, but he's making an interesting point there. Arlene, I want to turn that to you. He is pinning on this on the Democrats if they can't get at least 9 to cross the aisle.
Well, It's got to be bipartisan. You know, Schumer rightly pointed out that after having the Democrats agree to 3 previous stopgap measures, if they do this one, there's just no incentive for the Republicans to negotiate in good faith. And apparently that's what's happened now for month after month after month. So, you know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on me. And now that's happened 3 times and you got to draw the line and say we have to negotiate in good faith. Because the truth of the matter is this happens all the time. It happens in the courts. It happens when you buy a home or a car. It's the way the human beast works. They just got to get it together and do it.
Yeah, Jim, your thoughts on that?
Look, I think it's the ball's up in the air as to who's going to get the blame for this. I think if the Republicans can muster 50-plus in the Senate, it may be seen by the American public, or at least the American public that pays any attention, to be probably more on the Democratic side. And the fact that there is a chip, this chip funding in this, I think there could be a price to pay. By the same token, it doesn't seem that the Republicans can get there. I think that Rand Paul has come out against. Mm-hmm. I think Mike Rounds has come out against. I think Lindsey Graham has come out against. So I think this would be a share of blame to go all the way around. I don't think the Republicans will own all of it. They'll own a lot of it.
Yeah. Maybe I'm being too naive here, but I'm still thinking about what you mentioned about the process being broken. And over the course of this week, I've had this sort of dark knot of cynicism growing in the pit of my stomach, because here we are, right, on Friday, and we have DACA and CHIP and the United States military. Just take those three, for example. Three, you know, individually incredibly important programs, groups, organizations, what have you, literally being used as pawns against each other by hardcore partisans in Washington. Even just saying that, I know people are going to get mad depending on what your political viewpoint is, because they're going to say it's all just one side's fault or the other. But at the core of it, that's what's happening. Like they're being played against each other. And to me, I don't know, again, I keep thinking maybe it's just because I'm like hopelessly naive, but it's a terrible outcome that we find ourselves in. This should not be how government is done.
No, it shouldn't be. I mean, look, DACA should go through a regular legislative process, and people should have debates, and it should be a piece of legislation that makes a decision. And it should not be done as part of a continuing resolution as to whether you're going to shut the government down or not. Same thing on
unless
the
you have no choice, unless the majority party, who, in this case it happens to be Republicans, unless they refuse to do it in any other form, then this is your only one and only moment of leverage.
Well, then it is fundamentally broken, right? Because we shouldn't be. I mean, but I think your point is well taken, Arlene. But that, again, I think is the proof is in the pudding, and the pudding's a giant mess right now. Okay, well, so they've got, I'm looking at the clock here, it's 3:24, so I can't do that math, 8.5 hours? 8 hours and 40-ish minutes? 8 hours and 20 minutes? I don't know. To see if they can sort this out. So let's hope so. All right. Let's move on now and switch gears entirely and talk a little bit about Boston and the business world, because GE, which now makes Boston its home, is 2017 was a terrible year for GE. Let's just put it that way. Worst performing stock on the Dow. And this week, GE CEO John Flannery said all options are on the table to turn the company around, including a breakup. So what would that mean for Boston? We've got some tape here. This is Ann Klee, GE's Vice President of Boston Development and Operations. She spoke with us here at WBUR, and she says, no worries, Boston. GE is going to keep its promises to the city.
We're doing lots of things already in Boston and the surrounding communities. We've got lots more in the pipeline ready to go. And, you know, that's on top of GE executives really getting involved in the community. GE is massively committed to Boston, and we're thrilled to be here.
Great. But Jim, what do you think? If the company breaks up, does it make a difference to Boston for as long as they keep their commitments regarding their headquarters?
Well, you know, I don't think so. I think it matters because all the ripple effects that we expected to come out of it, the vendor networks and all the rest, would be impacted, obviously. I think I'd just like to step back on one thing you asked in the beginning. You said this is a terrible year for GE. And a couple of thoughts on that. One is that I think what we realized is that Jeffrey Immelt was somewhere between a disaster for the company in terms of manager and someone who completely killed the Jack Welch mystique. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing is I do think things will get worse before they get better. And if you listen to, well, a couple of things. When a CFO and Jeff Bornstein was pushed out, it seems, in a surprise move, and in their investor call, they were talking about how what they're dealing with right now is regards GE Capital, which was spun off before.
Yep.
They said, we do not believe that the issues rise to the level of securities violations. When I hear that, I say, right. So, I mean, they have restatements of all kinds of issues, and they may have to actually restate their revenues and their earnings. That will drive down their stock further. That may make them a good buy for someone to invest in, too. But it's going to be a rough ride for a while. That's the only thing I wanted to say.
Look, it's a great buy right now, even given just its 2017 drop. But I'm glad you mentioned GE Capital, though, because that was part of the Jack Welch mystique was, you know, according to some sort of people who take a more cynical view of him, he was playing a financial shell game with GE's financial holdings. But Arlene, your point, your thoughts.
Well, it's interesting to hear Jim's perspective from the private sector side. From the public sector side, I find the whole business a little troubling. Firstly, GE has already pushed back the second phase of the opening of two buildings two years further than they had originally promised. And this brings up the whole question about the pros and cons of taxpayer money being used to bolster, and this is my version of it, bolster corporate profits in order to lure a company someplace. And, you know, you always have to ask the question, where does the money come from? Mm-hmm. So if you're taking money from the poor, the sick, the needy to bolster a corporation's profits, in this case it happens to be GE, I think that we need to have certain things in place, a clawback provision, which I understand there may have been something of that akin in there. And
In terms of hiring.
So they can't promise the world and then not deliver. But also I think that we need sort of a reverse prenup where if the corporation abandons the marriage or reneges on their marriage vows, I think they should have to pay triple damages because that money would have been used for something else. It would have been used for people who were desperately needy at the moment, but it was set aside for a corporation, and then the corporation changed its minds or circumstances changed.
Okay, so on the other hand, I'll give a hat tip to Shirley Leung because in the Boston Globe, she was much more bullish about all of this, and she said worst case scenario, the city and state just have a couple of high value pieces of property on their hands, and since Boston is growing, she feels totally confident that someone will come and use it. So she didn't seem so cloudy as you did.
I read her piece, but if you'll notice, her piece also says, as long as the economy remains strong, comma, as long as South Boston real estate remains strong, comma, as long as this, you know. So there's all these caveats, and they may end up being true and we may be fine. But what if we hit another recession? The what if is what concerns me, because unless they can guarantee it, they've taken our money, our taxpayer dollars for a corporation, and it's simply and only for their profit margin.
Jim, are you in the as long as camp?
Look, I completely agree with Arlene. I think the fact is this is not the way to grow your economy. This is not the way we should have done. And I don't think that GE, at the end of the day, came for those reasons. I think they came because of the workforce and what was already here. What I would say is, you know, if you want to get ahead of ourselves and think about Amazon for a second, right, and say, all right, what lessons did we learn, right? I guess the first thing I'd say is there are clawback provisions in what they did. So that was smarter than just giving them the kitchen and saying, go and do what you need to do. But GE's different. And we would by drawing direct parallels between GE and Amazon, I think we might make a mistake in the sense that it's only 800 people. They were working on a heliport, let's say.
Not 50,000.
Not 50,000 where they need a transportation system. So if we do want to create incentives for Amazon, I would urge folks to think about a heavy investment in signals, infrastructure, the T, because that is the weakest portion of our application in that for HQ2, that and housing. And housing is a little bit of a different issue. But we would be better to promise that we'll put X dollars into the T for the infrastructure than we would be, hey, Amazon, you get tons of money. We're going to give you more.
I am completely on board with that, Jim, because not only would it make Greater Boston a more attractive place for a company like Amazon, but that is an investment that directly has a positive impact on the million people who ride the MBTA every day. So let's talk a little bit more about Amazon because, as we know, this week Boston made the shortlist of the top 20 locations for Amazon's HQ2. And yesterday, I should say, just to be clear, Amazon didn't put the list out in like rank order. They just said, here's the top 20. But yesterday, reporters asked Boston Mayor Marty Walsh if there were any lessons for Boston from GE regarding Amazon. And here's what Mayor Walsh said.
It's similar in the sense of, obviously, they're monster giant companies, GE and Amazon. But they're different in the sense of GE moved their corporate headquarters from one city to another, to Boston. Amazon is not doing that. Amazon is looking for a second headquarters. And I think if Amazon was going to be down, I don't see any time in the future Amazon going smaller. It seems like they're just getting bigger every day.
That's Marty Walsh channeling Jim Sturgis. Okay, let's hear what Governor Charlie Baker had to say.
I think the fact that Massachusetts continues to be part of the smaller universe with respect to Amazon's decision about where it might choose to locate its second headquarters is just a great statement about the quality of the people, the quality of the institutions, and frankly, the quality of life we have here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Woohoo! Okay. No, I mean, like, look, he's right to cheerlead. He's right to cheerlead. I'm not slighting Governor Baker there. I honestly, he's right to cheerlead. This region has a ton going for it that I think would be very attractive to a company like Amazon. But to this question of incentives, the last time I talked to Mayor Walsh was just before he had put in the bid, and he was kind of coy about whether or not there were any direct incentives. There weren't at the time, but he says he's open. He's open to some negotiations. So just to key off what Jim said earlier, Arlene, what kinds of incentives do you think would best benefit the region and not just Amazon?
Well, that's exactly. I agree with you and with Jim on this one. You know, it's nice to be on the dance card for Amazon. You know, it's flattering and it is seductive to be offered 50,000 good paying jobs. And who's going to say no to that? There are some cautionary notes we have to keep in mind, some warning signs. We already have affordable housing problems mm-hmm. on a significant level in this state. Our transportation system is already stressed. Income disparities are already bad enough. What will be the ramifications of having this come? Well, might it be good or might it be bad? I think that there's some arguments that can be made on both sides. But I think Boston has to stop. I think we suffer, a la Shirley's comments in the Globe, a little bit from an inferiority complex. We are an attractive city. We have, you know, the brains, we have the history, we have the sports, we have the culture. And it's the quality of life, as one of you just said, that brings these companies in. So I don't think we need to start courting them with money.
Yeah.
I think we court them with things that benefit society. At large, like transportation, you were just saying.
I agree, because other people have said this. Not one penny, unless that money goes to improving fundamentals here. That's vastly need improvement on. And maybe there's an opportunity to partner with Amazon on some of those improvements. Jim, your thoughts on that?
I think they want to do their business is what I think they want to do. I mean, honestly, that's what companies want to do at the end of the day. And the one thing I would say is, look, I am completely in Arlene's camp. We've opposed a number of these incentive programs because they tend not to work over the longer period. You get one hit, yep, but 10 miss, right? The thing I'd say is we want them. Because jobs are great. I'd rather be Boston with a slightly, with a problem with inequality than Springfield without jobs, to be quite honest. If that's the choice we have to make, because jobs lead to more money being put into the community and more jobs for other folks, it's just a better way to go. That's
Jim,
my view.
Jim, you know that we're friends, but I'm gonna badger you here a little bit, because tell that to the Bostonians right now who are paying $2,700 for a postage stamp size one bedroom.
Yep. Understand. What I would also say, just to make you even angrier.
I'm not angry. I'm just channeling the emotions of our listeners.
Is the only thing I'd say on top of that is you don't start with money. But if at the end of the day you're Atlanta versus Boston and they're putting $200 million on the table and they come to you and say, if you put $300 on the table, what do you choose? For a governor, for a mayor, I hate it. But the reality is, what do?
You put $300 million into the MBTA.
Yes, I second that motion.
No, I'm just, you know.
Well, it would be a nice question to ask if the reality presents itself. So we'll see. All right, well, we've got just enough time for our hubbubs. And this is the kind of week where I need some good news. So so actually, I don't know if this is good news or bad news. I'm going to start with my hubbub because we're talking about the tea. And Jim, this one's especially for you. This is news that is breaking today. I'm seeing here in the Herald, hat tip to the Boston Herald, that the tea and labor leaders say they've reached a tentative bargaining agreement with the MBTA's union that represents the T's bus mechanics. And this could actually thwart the Baker administration's attempts to partially privatize some of the bus garages here. This has been a long and very thorny negotiation. Look, my browser just crashed, so that's as much as I've got for you. But that breaking news from the Herald. But it's interesting because this was a major change that the Baker administration wanted to try out at the T, politically problematic, but it looks like they may not even get the chance. Just your quick thought on that?
I haven't seen the details of it, so I really don't know. And I think as part of the negotiation with the Carmen's Union, there was a lot that was really, really good for all sides in that. So it worked out. For everybody, I haven't seen the details. It'd be hard to say anything.
Okay, fair enough. I like people who say, I actually want to know what I'm talking about before I talk about it. So, Jim, what about your hubbub?
I will admit that my hubbub, which is supposed to be something below the fold, is well below the fold. It does address a longstanding, in fact, a 1,000-year need of Leif Erikson aficionados on this side of the Atlantic. There will be two new axe throwing bars coming to the greater Boston area in 2018. Congratulations. We are now as hip as Maine and Canada. This news will strike a chord with many, especially firefighters, those with an axe to grind, and those who need a beer and a good cry after getting the axe, not to mention those who are looking for a place to meet bearded guys clad in plaid. Look for one in Union Square, Somerville, where else? And the other in Everett. Further evidence, if any was needed, that Everett has arrived.
Jim, is that your way of saying we'll see you there?
Absolutely. Axe
okay.
in hand.
An axe throwing bar. Great. Arlene, you get to be cleanup hitter today.
I see. Well, mine is on an equally high and noble ground. My hubbub is about the Google Arts and Culture app, which actually apparently has existed since 2016. And at the time, I'm told, it was about articles and features on artists and art history, and it would help a person explore different styles and art during different times in art histories. And apparently now they have added very recently a match your selfie function where you can take your face and match it to famous artwork, find yourself in famous artwork.
Have you done this?
I have not. Oh. I have not. So who am I to say any of this? But apparently you can find your artistic doppelganger and by downloading this free app. But beware. Because you might not like the results. In fact, it's really been quite funny. In the last 48 hours, I've read all these hysterical postings from people I know who have talked about their disappointment and their upset in who they were matched to, which artists and artwork they were matched to. I had a cousin who lives north of Boston in Georgetown who said when she was matched to an unfortunate-looking fellow that they had better pay for the therapy she will now need. So, well, I think it's wonderful if in fact, this app causes people to learn more about artists and art history. For that, I think it's great, but the other part is hysterical.
Have you done it, Jim?
I haven't, but I have a feeling I'd be St. John the Baptist with my head on the plate.
Like, none of us have done it. I won't do it on principle because I don't want to give a picture of my face to the Google machine. But my favorite one that I've seen online so far is someone had a picture of Clark Kent, and then the Google app matched it 100% to a picture of Superman. Well, Arlene Isaacson, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. It's always great to have you, Arlene. Thank you so much. Jim Sturgis, executive director at the Pioneer Institute. Always great to have you, too. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.